Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Okay, Reggie, how you doing, sir?
Yeah.
What? My voice sounds peppy. Oh, that's good. That's good to know since I'm doing a podcast right now. It's good that it's peppy. Well, let's keep the pep going then, and let's get right into it. Let's not waste any of that pep. I might have just enough pep, so I don't want to waste any pep now. Let's save the pep for the official podcast, okay? Interesting comment. Is that to say that I'm not usually peppy? I'm not even going to put you on the spot. Okay, I'm going to just let that. I'm going to absorb that comment and move on. Okay, and let's make sure that I've got enough pep in the tank. Okay, nice. All right, get your finger on the trigger. Put it down. Episode 410. Star, smile, strong. Here we go. 3, 2, 1. Hey, it's Elton Jim Toronto, and this is Captain Podtastic. And welcome to another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNradio.com or wherever you go to find your favorite podcast. We are there. But don't forget, listening is only one little piece of the experience here. The other part is to get out there and spread the word. Tell your friends, tell your family, tell anybody who listens to a podcast that your favorite podcast is Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, and it should be theirs too. This is an election year, so you should get out there and start, you know, knocking on doors. And while you're talking about your favorite candidate, just throw in the podcast. Can't hurt. Your effort and loyalty are much appreciated. If you like what you hear, don't forget, you can hear more of this, whatever this is, as many times as you'd like, anytime you'd like, by just going to WGNradio.com, going to the podcast section, hitting the prompt for this podcast, Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, and my goodness, lots and lots of podcasts from the recent past, going back 2-3 years. Heck, we've been doing this since May of 2016. In fact, this is episode number 410. So, yes, episode 410, I just mentioned, and as we say, we're always excited about any kind of milestone number that ends with a 0 or a 5, so I guess 410 is a big deal, right? Yeah. 90 more to 500. 90 more. Well, that's about another almost 2 years, though. But we've been here for 410. There's no reason why we can't be here for number 500, right? I hope you will be along with as well, and I hope you've been along for the ride since. So we started in May of 2016, and we've done 410 episodes. And I should mention to you, I've got a producer here, engineer Reggie, that worked with me for several years now. And when we got into the studio, you don't get to hear any of this, obviously, because this is a very professional podcast, and you only hear what we want you to hear. We don't let you hear the before the podcast kind of discussions. You never know. It could get salty. It could get, you know, a little gossipy. So I don't really, you know, you only just hear when that music starts. But a few minutes before the podcast starts, I get in the studio and we start talking. But, you know, that's idle chatter. So you don't get to hear that, unfortunately. But Reggie said, wow, you sound peppy today. Like, wow, I didn't know whether to take that as a compliment or an insult, as opposed to what, I don't sound peppy usually? So I told them, well, let's get started then. You know, get the music ready and I'll start doing the intro because I don't want to lose any of my pep. If I only have an hour or so of pep in me, I want to make sure that all the pep goes into the actual podcast. I don't want to waste time chatting with him beforehand. So, boom. I'm peppy and happy and bursting with life. And if you're a fan of the Odd Couple television show, you'll get that reference, all three of you. Happy and peppy and bursting with life like a little pup. Very, very obscure reference. If you get that one, give yourself a gold star. So I wanted to talk about today was temptation. It's like, ooh, Jim, this sounds like an Oprah show. Well, no, it's not going to get into anything lurid, but it is. I wasn't surprised I was tempted, but I was when all was said and done of this little episode here, I was surprised that I resisted the temptation, and I guess I was both happy and sad in a way. It revealed something about me, and I have mixed feelings about it. And maybe, you know, just by talking it out here, I can resolve that. And you say, my goodness, Jim, this sounds, you know, this podcast is usually, you know, kind of lighthearted to some extent. I don't try to make things really heavy here. Don't talk about politics, especially in today's world, very divisive. And even some of the big issues of the day, it's, you know, I don't want to alienate anybody. The whole goal of this podcast is to draw people in. And in today's world, on so many big issues and topics, you know, you could say one thing and it gets misconstrued or misinterpreted seven different ways from what you expected. So I don't try to get into that all the time. I've certainly over the years have talked about certain events and political things that have affected all of us, but I still try to give an even explanation of it, give both sides. It's tied into my kind of journalism background, having started my career as a reporter. So I always try to give both sides and be as objective on a topic as I can in describing it. But then I'm certainly, hey, I give my opinion. There's no question about that. I have very strong opinions on things. I'm not afraid to offer them to you, and then you can agree with them or not. But hopefully, the goal is that if you disagree with them, that you don't just automatically say, well, then I'm done with you. That's what's happening a lot today. If somebody disagrees with you, they cut you off. That's why we have very little compromise. We have very little dialogue because everybody's in their camps and they're dug in deep. And, you know, I enjoy, as Irv Kupcinet once said, once again, Google that one and you get a gold star if you remember Irv Kupcinet or Cup, who was a very famous and well-known, well, that's the same thing, a well-known columnist here in the Chicago area for decades. There's even, I think there's still a statue of Irv Kupcinet downtown near the Trump Tower, because that's where the Sun-Times building used to be located, where the Trump Tower is now downtown, not far from the Wrigley building. And Cup was at the Sun-Times for, as I said, several decades, and he was kind of a gossip raconteur bon vivant. He went to all the openings, he knew all the politicians, he knew all the celebrities, he knew all the restaurant owners, you know, and his column was called Cup's Column. And what was going on in Chicago for a long time, Cup had his finger on the pulse of Chicago. I'm not sure if that was a good thing. He was definitely a throwback, but he was a man of his time, and that's the way things were back then. But yeah, Irv Kupcinet, Cup was a big presence here in Chicago and nationally. He knew a lot of national celebrities. When they'd come into town, they all went to see Cup and talk to Cup and blah blah blah. And his name was Irv Kupcinet, so his nickname was Cup. And he actually was for a while, he broadcasted on the radio the Bears games. So he was very in the fabric of Chicago for, oh my gosh, probably 50, if not more, years. He really was a major presence. And for a while in the 70s and 80s, he was even a TV personality. He would appear on the Channel 2 News and give little updates as to what's going on. And he also had a television show, a talk show, on Channel 11 here. And he would have national and local celebrities, politicians, you name it, all on the couches with him, and they'd all talk. And he would always say, Irv Kupson here, celebrating the lively art of conversation. I always liked that phrase. Even as a young kid, I didn't even really understand what it meant, but it flowed so well. And as I got older and understood, I really liked it, the lively art. And then it would just be, then he would even cut, it was first the lively art of conversation. And then he would even, you know, it became such a tagline for him that he stopped even saying of conversation, said here to enjoy the lively art. And I just love that. I might adopt that. I think Cup's been gone long enough, and I'm pay a little subtle tribute to Cup, and I like that. Practicing the lively art of conversation. But sadly, the lively art of conversation has been stifled. We don't have lively arts of conversation. We have screaming matches, and there is no give and take. I love a good conversation with somebody. Sometimes I will even take the other side that might, I don't even really, believe in, but I would, if I see somebody with a strong opinion on something, I might just play devil's advocate on purpose just to hear more and to get their insights. Like I said, it comes from my early training as a journalist to be objective, to try to draw things out of people. And so if I agree with them, then we're kind of all on the same page, and all we do is just confirm what we already believe. And then you don't learn as much. But if you're talking to somebody and they're giving you a whole new perspective on something, you may agree with some of that, you may not. But at least you're hearing the opposing view or a different perspective, and perhaps it might not completely convince you to change your opinion, but it also may add some new information that makes you maybe reconsider or look at things in a different way. And I wish we had more of that. We don't really have much conversation anymore. We're talking at each other, and we're not listening. You should listen to the talking heads and the panelists on TV shows, especially on our news networks, and it's mostly contentious. And I understand, I've gotten in heated arguments as well, or in heated discussions, which shows your passion for that, and I don't find that there's anything wrong with that, but I do try to listen and hear another side, and then consider it. And sometimes I say, no, I don't really agree with that, but it's an interesting take on that. At least I've taken a step back and thought about it for a couple of minutes, or maybe a couple of days, before I say, well, it's an interesting take on that, but I still don't agree with it. But at least I was open to it, and at least I was exposed to it. That's the other side of the coin, too, here. We're not getting exposed to a lot of things that we don't agree with. And that's a problem. That's why we're so divided right now. We're not listening. Not only are we not listening to the other side, we're not even aware of what the other side really thinks. I have strong opinions and strong views on things, but I still watch CNN and Fox News and MSNBC. They're all widely divergent in their perspectives and point of views of what they think about the news and how they report it. But I'd like to get the full picture. and News Nation as well. I watched that too, which supposedly is trying to be somewhere in the middle, and we'll see how that works in terms of in this climate. But I try to watch all perspectives, and then I make up my decision. Sometimes it changes me, sometimes it doesn't. But at least I expose myself to it. Okay, I don't know how I got on that. Well, I mentioned Cup in the Lively Art of Conversation. And I'm just saying, I enjoy the Lively Art of Conversation. Let's put it that way. And but so here's what I was my main topic, and I hope you once again, if you listen to the podcast on a regular basis, you'll realize I will take little diversions and detours away, but I eventually come back. I eventually come back, and hopefully there's some kernels of information and knowledge of that would interest you when I take these little divergent paths. I always live by the Robert Frost poem. I took the road, and now I'm blanking on it, and it made all the difference. What's the road? The road unused? Oh my God, I feel terrible. I love that Robert Frost, that Robert Frost poem, and now I'm blanking on it. but I'll remember it. Don't worry. The road not taken. Yes. I took the road not taken, and it made all the difference. That's the phrase, and that's the poem by Robert Frost. And I like to take the road untaken sometimes, not taken, just to see what's there. And so sometimes I will go down these little detours and talk about topics that aren't even anything to do with my main topic, but hopefully they shed a little light and information and entertainment and information. Who knows? But what I really want to talk about, as I said before, is temptation. And you say, wow, Jim, wow, that's a pretty heavy topic. What the heck tempted you? I said, I'm a little, you know, I'm surprised at the temptation, and I'm a little happy by it and sad of what it revealed, because I was able to resist it. And you say, wow, Jim, this is really a heavy topic. Well, wait till you hear the whole thing. I mean, let's remember that my nickname is Elton Jim, right? Okay, that's a key element to this entire discussion. I don't talk about Elton all that much. I don't want to, you know, I'm not here to talk about Elton John's music or his career on a weekly basis. I certainly could do that, and it might be interesting. There's a lot of people actually that do that already. But every so often, I try to talk about myself. And as I said, you know, Elton John has played a major role influentially in my life. He's enriched his music and his career and his actions have taught me, have entertained me, have enriched me, have influenced me in many ways. He just had a birthday last week, turned 77. But so I had an Elton John temptation that I was surprised that I was able to resist. And as I said, and when I resisted it, it made me happy, or I don't know if happy is the word, but it also made me sad, because I felt like, wow, is there a part of me that's changing or going away? So yeah, this is kind of a little deep thing, but also kind of fun, since that it's about Elton John, right? But maybe, you know, if you have some views, as I said all the time, we can't correspond instantly or through this podcast, but you can always put a comment on my Facebook page. I always put a link to this podcast 3 days a week on Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays, and you're free to comment on that specific podcast or anything else as a way to communicate. So here's the thing. Earlier this year, there was a big announcement that Elton John was going to have an auction of some of his personal items, and possessions that he has collected over the years. In large part, the possessions that adorned the walls and the space of his huge Atlanta condo complex. Many people don't know that since around 1991, Elton John, until just recently, just like last year, Elton John had a residence in Atlanta and lived there in a good part of the time. It wasn't just a vanity address. He lived there, especially throughout much of the 90s and even into the early 2000s, and still frequently lived there, especially during his touring. And it sounds like an odd place for Elton John, of his stature and his fame, to live in a place like Atlanta, especially since it's in the Deep South. And here's Elton John, probably the world's most famous homosexual, right, who espouses, gay rights and gay activism, and he's got his own AIDS foundation, and he's very, open-minded and liberal-minded, and he's sort of in the heart of the South, which would seem very contradictory. But he fell in love with the lifestyle and found that the Atlanta area was very open to him. And Atlanta adopted him in many ways. The local city adopted him as their adopted son, and certainly were used him in ways of for tourism to say, "Hey, Elton John lives here," because it was such an odd choice. Yes, I mean, certainly Elton, has a couple of residences in his home country of England, and yes, he has a big spread now in Los Angeles. He also has a place in France and in Venice, and he's bought another one in Canada, in Toronto. It's still being built. So he's got residences all over the world. But he did use Atlanta as a major residence for many years, and even right up until last year, because he would use it as a spot to stay in during his touring. After years of touring around the world and staying and going, city to city every couple of days and staying in hotels, that's kind of cool when you're 22 or 23. But when you get to be 55 or 60 or 70, you like to have some roots. You like to be home. And he certainly has the wealth to do that. And so what he would do, because he had a private plane, For the last 25 years or so, this is not just anything relatively new, but for the last 25 years or more, if he toured in any city, for the most part, that was east of the Mississippi River, he would fly to that show on his private jet, arrive in that town usually around 3:30, 4 o'clock, something like that, sometimes later, depending, and take a nap and rest up and then get ready for the show that usually started at 8 o'clock. And then when the show was over, as soon as it was over, he would immediately leave the stage, jump into a car, get escorted by police to the airport, around 11 o'clock, long before people were getting out, so he wasn't getting stuck in traffic. And he would get to the airport, and he would probably be on the plane home while people were still in the parking lot. And because from the east of the Mississippi to Atlanta, which has a major airport, Hartsfield Airport, anywhere from the east of the Mississippi to Atlanta was maybe a two-hour flight, depending, 2.5. And so he could be home by 1 o'clock, 1:30, depending on the time change, obviously. If he was in the Midwest and he went to the Eastern time, he loses an hour. But my point is, he could sleep in his bed and be around, friends and family, and not you know, be on the road all the time. He could actually come back home. And so he did that for a long time. Now, people might say, how the heck did he get to Atlanta in the first part? That became an added bonus of the location of Atlanta. But it was also convenient for him because he does have a residence in England. And so if he was living in Atlanta for a while and then needed to go to England, back to his other home, well, he's right on the eastern coast. So he's not flying across the country. It's maybe a 6-hour flight then, as opposed to a 12-hour one from the West Coast, or even an 8 or 9 hour one from anywhere in the Midwest. He's already on the East Coast, and as I said before, Atlanta is a major airport, so he can fly out of there and go anywhere he wanted. So it was a good spot for him personally and professionally. But he got to Atlanta in a very interesting way, as he's made very public now, and it's become a major thing. In 1990, he started taking drugs in the mid 70s, and his cocaine habit especially ran rampant through the 70s and the 80s, and he was very close to death. And he was very, very sick, mentally and physically. He had not only a cocaine addiction, but he had an alcoholism addiction, and he even had bulimia. So there were many times where he had seizures, where he, had passed out. He had some heart problems. He's got a pacemaker. It's a credit to his resilience that he is still around, because he was in some bad shape. And in 1990, he went to rehab here in the Chicago area, which many people do not know. And it wasn't a fancy, celebrity kind of rehab center. It's actually called the Parkside Center. It's still there, and it's right next to and affiliated to, I still believe, to the Advocate Lutheran General Hospital in Park Ridge, Illinois. And because they were, at the time in 1990, they were the only rehab center that could address all three of his problems, the alcoholism, the drug addiction, and the bulimia. So that's where he went. He didn't go to some posh, rehab center, on some tropical island. There wasn't all the amenities. This was a very serious rehab center, which still is one of the best in the country. It's very strict. It is for people who are very serious about cleaning up, and cleaning up for good. And to his credit, he went there in 1990, and 34 years later, he is still clean and sober. So after that, he was in a relationship with a man who lived in Atlanta, who was from Atlanta. So he started to visit Atlanta because he was spending time with this person. And ultimately, he came to really fall in love with the city, the vibe of the city. It still had a nice art center. As I said before, the location was good. The weather was good. And he found that he could live something of a normal, whatever that means in Elton John's world, normal life. The people and the city of Atlanta didn't hassle him. He could go out and drive his car on his own, especially it was part of his early treatment to do things for himself, because he had been pampered for so much of his life. His life changed forever when he was 23 years old. He was riding on planes and in limos. So by the time 1990 came, when he was about 43 years old, he had lived 20 years of a high flying, stardom filled, money filled lifestyle. And So he felt the lifestyle in Atlanta was much more low key. It wasn't as frantic and celebrity obsessed as LA or New York. The people there didn't bother him. He got involved in local organizations and activities. He felt a freedom there that he could actually live, as I said, whatever that means for someone of that kind of stature and fame, a normal life. He would go to the local Tower Records every Tuesday and go shopping. And so he really came to love Atlanta. He first bought one condo in a complex. And of course, knowing Elton John, one is never enough, which is one reason why he got in trouble with his drug use. And so he wound up, I believe, buying 5 or 6 condos and making one big, you know, knocking down ceilings and walls. And it was multi-tiered. I think it grew to like 19,000 square feet totally when he was all said and done. And as I said, he is a shopaholic, always has been. His shopping certainly played a much bigger role after his drug addiction stopped, because he needed something to fill that void and that outlet, and it was shopping. He wound up amassing one of the world's, and this is no exaggeration, amassing one of the world's greatest photography collections. He's a big art lover, and he loves glassware and paintings and furniture, and you name it. You know, he was very proud of the fact that many times his homes have been featured in Architectural Digest, including his Atlanta complex, which was located on one of the main streets in Atlanta called Peachtree Road. So when his tour ended, now his touring life, his big farewell tour ended in 2023, the need to be in Atlanta wasn't as strong, because he wouldn't need it now as this kind of touring home base as he used it for the last 25 years. Plus, with his children who were going to school in London, once again, Atlanta seemed to not be as pivotal in his life anymore. His life had changed with no touring and with children. As I said, he had a big spread in Los Angeles, because he still does a lot of things with his career, recording music, his AIDS Foundation galas, and things like that, the film business, which he's still involved in, as well as then being in his home base in his mansion in London. So it was decided that they were going to sell the condominium, the whole complex, which they did for like $7 million. And as I said, he has several other residences. He wasn't selling all of his possessions, but he had a lot of stuff jammed into 19,000 square feet of that complex, and so the thought was that maybe we should auction some of these things off, some of these possessions. Now, he's been a collector for most of his life, and as a collector myself, it's not easy to let go of things. And I've talked about that on this podcast many ways. You may remember, if you're a longtime listener, I talked about decluttering. And I talked about decluttering long before it became a word. I'm still saying that I coined that when I was on the radio at WGN. We were talking about it one day when I was with Gary Meyer, and I said, when I turned 50, I said, I am going to start to declutter. I'm going to start to collect experiences more than material things. And that was before that whole term. I truly believe that I coined that phrase and started that. Regardless, I'm not going to get credit for it. I know that. But anyway, and I've said how I, when I'm in this kind of decluttering mood, especially I went through it about 4 or 5 years ago, where I got rid of a lot of stuff. It was liberating to throw some of this stuff out, because it was felt like it was suffocating me. And And so the idea here was to, you know, sell some of these things that they would no longer have this residence. They didn't sell everything because obviously they have other residences. There may have been some pieces and other things that they wanted to keep and maybe put into this new residence they're having built in. It's an apartment building. Actually, got a tree in it. It's just really got to be an amazing place. It's this apartment in a new building that's being a high rise that's being built in Toronto, but it's going to have a tree in it, a real living tree. How crazy is that? But and how cool is that? So I'm sure that they're going to take some of the possessions from this Atlanta place and decorate that. And they said they have other residences. But for the most part, they were going to get rid of, or auction at least. I mean, get rid of sounds. They were just going to declutter. to use a phrase that I created. And auction some of these things off. Some people may remember, but back in 1988, he had a similar auction. He was going through this same kind of thing. As I said, he went to rehab in 1990. And in 1988, he was feeling this restlessness. And at that time, he was still, his drug problem was very serious. But he was going through, he was beginning to see the need to change his life, even though he really didn't. But there was a at least at that time, a very concerted effort to maybe get a new outlook on life. And 2 years later, he then dedicated himself to that. But in 88, he was at least beginning to feel that need and seeing how serious his life needed to change. And so he had a huge auction through the auction house of Sotheby's. And he auctioned off a lot of his personal possessions that were in his homes at the time, as well as many of his famous costumes. He was trying to shed in some ways. You could tell it was a psychological thing going on. He was trying to shed the Elton John image, even though he really could never do that. And I don't think at the end of the day he really wants to shed that, but he was feeling that at the time. And so he sold many of his well-known stage costumes, as well as, I said, different possessions, jewelry, furniture, and things like that. But the stage costumes were the big things. He sold many of his eyeglasses. At that time in 1988, he sold the original Dodger Stadium uniform costume that was designed by Bob Mackie that he wore in his historic 1975 Dodger Stadium shows. In fact, he just got that back last year because the Hard Rock Cafe bought it and the auction at Sotheby's, and they were presenting it and displaying it throughout different Hard Rock Cafes around the world. I saw it at many different places, Hard Rock Cafes. And I think he realized that's one of his iconic outfits that he probably wished he didn't sell. And so he actually made a trade with the Hard Rock about a year and a half ago to get it back. He gave them a new jacket that he was wearing on his current tour, and he agreed to do a performance for the Hard Rock Cafe employees and company in London. And for that, he got the original Dodger Stadium, or Dodgers, you know, sequined Dodger uniform costume back. So he had this huge auction and made several million dollars on it. And so I think they thought, well, you know, 40 years, you know, 35 years later, it's not a bad idea. And so using a different auction house, Christie's, another well-known auction house, they decided to have an auction of a major part of the possessions that filled the Peachtree Road residence, actually calling it Goodbye Peachtree Road as a takeoff on, of course, Goodbye Yellow Brick Road. He was saying goodbye to Peachtree Road with both his possessions and moving out of Atlanta. And so in January of this year, a few months ago, the announcement came out that they were going to have this major auction. And maybe it was before the maybe it was even before January, but this major auction was going to take place in February at Christie's in New York City. And they said that, you know, there was going to be mostly of the possessions. He did actually sell many of his well-known photographs in his collection. He actually sold a lot of those, as well as, you know, couches and chairs, Versace designed chairs and different artworks and a Bentley convertible. The one I told you about that he probably drove around in Atlanta, as well as, even though it didn't fit the thing, they did sell some of his costumes as well, including a pair of his EJ boots. I think he had several of these because I've seen them in various and other places and auctions. But there was EJ boots, that these 6-inch heels, silver EJ boots that he had worn. And you could see that they were worn because they were scuffed up. I say that because I went to Christie's in New York in early February on the first day that it was open to the public to see all the objects. I mean, there was 900 items in this auction, and Christie's has a 2 or 3 tiered showroom. It was set up like an art gallery, and all 900 items were on display because, once again, it was, people were there to buy them. So you had a chance to see them and touch many of the things. And some things were in, you know, a lot of the jewelry, people were trying it on because what the heck? I mean, it was like an interactive museum, really, because, you know, in a museum, there's all these cool pieces of art or cool, you know, different items, but you're not allowed to touch them. Many times they're behind glass or they're behind some kind of a security thing and, you know, ropes. And you can't touch them. And here, it was odd because you could touch them. And at first, people were very, we were there the first day, and you could see everybody was kind of treating it like a museum. And that open gallery was there for about 2 weeks before the auction. And as I saw more people going to it and posting things on Facebook, I saw people touching it, wearing some of the things, because after all, you know, these things might be something at what they weren't there just to look at. They'll be there to purchase. So if you wanted to buy that car, for instance, you'd want to sit in it, right? It's not like going to a car museum where, oh, don't touch, don't sit. If I wanted to buy that Bentley convertible, I want to sit in it. I might not be able to drive it, but I want to sit in it. If I want to buy a costume of Elton's, I want to see what it feels like. I want to really touch it, not just look at it in a case like if I went to a museum or the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So it was an interesting added bonus. It was, as I said before, it was an interactive exhibition in many ways. In many ways, it was like an art installation or exhibition of all this. You know, there were costumes on the mannequins and things like that, but there were also costumes on hangers that you could touch and maybe even put on. A lot of the glasses were in cases. They didn't want you to ruin that. And people weren't walking around with bird costumes. But my point is, you could actually touch the material and get right on them. They weren't behind glass because they were meant to be bought. You know how it's like when you go shopping, right? You want to touch and feel and see. So it was a very interesting, you know, thing to go to. And of course, being an Elton fan, I had to go to that because there were many objects, especially a lot of the stage costumes that, you know, I had seen in person myself going to see him in concert over the years. The glasses and some of the suits and some of the wigs and all these different things. And so it got a chance to actually see them up close, to touch them, and see all of these things that I had seen many times. As I said before, there were pictures of in Architectural Digest and different places of this Atlanta residence and the way it was decorated. And I saw pictures of a lot of these things, but here was a chance to actually see and touch these things in person. And so in February, early February, on the opening day, I flew to New York just for a day, got there in the morning, left in the evening, spent about 2.5-3 hours in the Christie's Museum just looking at all of these different items, which gets now to the temptation. So, about, I would say, 10 years ago or so, on one of his stage outfits that he was wearing regularly was designed by, he's always used different designers, depending, you know, for a period of time. On his last tour, he used Gucci exclusively. But he's had different designers through the years. Some high-profile ones, some not as high-profile. He just likes their work and their designs. And so he was wearing these suits that had long coats. And they were decorated with different designs on the back, on the sleeves, on the side, on the front. You know, they were beaded, they were painted, it was all of them, there was a lot of sequins, obviously. And they all had different designs on them. Some of them were very cool. They would say Rocket Man or EJ on the back. There was one of them that had that was a recreation of one of his famous early and one of his best albums, Madman Across the Water, which the original cover was a picture of an embroidered, you know, hand stitched Madman Across the Water on denim. It became a very popular, iconic album cover. And that was recreated on the back of the coat, which he did not get rid of that one. That one he did not get rid of. My favorite Elton John album is an album called Captain Fantastic and the Brown Dirt Cowboy, which came out in 1975, and which is the first album in the history of the Billboard charts to ever enter the chart at number one. No one had ever done that before. Not Frank Sinatra, not Glenn Miller, not the Beatles, no one had ever entered the chart before 1975 at number one. Elton John did it twice, in fact, with two albums in a row, Captain Fantastic, and then in May of 75 and in November of 75, he put out Rock of the Westies, and that one went number one on its first week of being released. Now that's commonplace, but back then, that didn't happen. As I said, some of the greatest heavyweights in the history of music, Elvis, the Beatles, Sinatra, any generation, Simon and Garfunkel, name anybody. Nobody did it. Barbra Streisand, no. Madonna, no. Later, yes, but not before that. Not before 1975. Madonna was later. But the ones before that, you know, Elvis, the Beatles, the biggest stars, no one did it before Elton did. He did it twice. And to me, it's his best album. It's the essence of Elton John. And not only does it tell an autobiographical story of how he and Bernie Taupin met and started their careers as songwriters, but the songs are very personal, and you could feel that Elton feels a connection to those music. The band sounds great. The production by Gus Dudgeon is probably his best work. And as I said before, the Elton John band of Nigel Olsen and Davy Johnstone and Dee Murray and Roy and Ray Cooper at the time, the album just it's vintage Elton John, the Elton John sound. It's all there, and it was highlighted by the major hit "Someone Saved My Life Tonight." And when it came out, it was Elton John was so popular at the time. It was an elaborate album package. There was this just stunning and complex and just compelling cover art that folded out by a guy named Alan Aldridge, who has passed away. But Alan Aldridge was one of the great illustrators, and he got his start illustrating different books and things for the Beatles, and especially in the late 60s, and he became one of the best-known illustrators for rock albums. And so he did the classic cover for Captain Fantastic and the Brown Dirt Cowboy. And in this package, there was a poster of that cover, and there was a lyric book, and there was a scrapbook of different items of Elton and Bernie's early career, which the album celebrated. It was an amazing packaging, and it fit how great the music was too. And so it remains my favorite album. And throughout the tour, about 10, 15 years ago, he would wear this one coat many times, and I saw it many times. He had at least three different incarnations of it. He had a sky blue one, a red one, and like a dark greenish, grayish one. And on the back was the very distinctive logo of Captain Fantastic. Well, when I saw that, I just flipped. As I said, that's my favorite album. And I was like, wow, I love that jacket. And it was a suit. It had, pants that went with it that were a little spangled, sparkled on the side. But it was the jacket. And every time on that tour, I always hoped he would be wearing the Captain Fantastic jacket. He had several different designs, many, probably 50 or 60. But then as the tour went on, you could see that the ones that he enjoyed wearing the most, and he wore the Captain Fantastic one several times. It used to drive me crazy because the logo of Captain Fantastic is very distinctive. If you ever see the album, it's of red and yellow. And the Fantastic part is in these kind of old Gothic looking, letters. And the Captain part is a little smaller, and it's almost got like a winged look to it. And the Captain part, even on the album, is a little, it's not in the same script as the Fantastic, and it's a little smaller. Now, on the album, it's easier to read. Well, on this jacket, the Captain part wasn't as prominent. But anybody who knew Elton John knew that that was the Captain Fantastic logo. So you knew it was a Captain Fantastic. Like I said before, he had the logo of Madman Across the Water on one jacket, and clearly he had the logo for Captain Fantastic on another one. And that's who he is. He was Captain Fantastic, and Bernie Taupin was the Brown Dirt Cowboy. As I said, the album was autobiographical about how they met and their early years as songwriters. So for the fans like me, and we knew that that was the Captain Fantastic logo. But many of the reviewers online and in newspapers, well, they're younger now. And they weren't even around for Captain Fantastic. So it used to drive me crazy because clearly they were younger writers who didn't even know of the album, perhaps. Certainly didn't know the logo. And from a faraway distance, you just saw the Fantastic. The Captain was there, but it was smaller. And it was actually kind of in dark sequins, so it wasn't as visible. But that was the Captain Fantastic logo, and it said Captain. But almost every review, except for people you could tell that were a little older and knew the reference, people would write in their reviews of the concerts, oh, and he wore this sequined jacket with Fantastic on the back. And it used to drive me crazy. It's like, no, it's Captain Fantastic. Well, I'd seen that jacket many times. And when I went to so many of the shows during that tour, I would be up close and I'd see that jacket right there. And I was always saying, as I said, I'm a collector. I have a pretty big Elton John collection of different things. And in the back of my mind, I said, gosh, one day, would it be great to own this suit and that jacket? I would love to have that jacket with the Captain Fantastic logo. My gosh, that would be the high point and the most coveted item in my collection. If I could get this Captain Fantastic jacket that he wore on stage. I love the album, It was so well designed, and it looked so cool, and it sparkled. And I said, "Wow! One day, I hope that these jackets are available, or maybe somewhere through some sources, I could get my hands on one of these things." I do have one of his jackets from the 70s, and I do have a pair of his glasses. But that, my gosh, that would have been the pinnacle. But it was in the back of my mind, and as I said, this was, you know, 10 years ago, if not more. So, what are the odds? What are the chances? Right. Well, when they announced this new Christie's auction, 900 items, and they said they were going to be auctioning off not only the possessions from his Atlanta residence, but also some stage costumes. So, of course, I had to go on and just see what they were going to be selling. As I said, I saw pictures of the Atlanta apartment many times, so it would have been cool to see what if they decide to sell, you know. So I went online to see. They put all the items up, online before they actually displayed them, about a month before or so they went online, so that people could start to get a look at it. Because I said, this was not a museum exhibition. This was meant to sell. They wanted to sell these things. So they weren't being coy. They were getting the word out. Hey, folks, here's what's for sale. Now, granted, this is expensive stuff on its face, and then add to that the fact that Elton John owned this stuff, or in the case of these costumes, wore these things. So, you know, this was going to be pricey. There's no question. I mean, Elton John has very expensive tastes. Some of these photographs, I said, it was one of the most prized photography collections in the world for people that collect photography. He had photographs, original photographs by people Richard Avedon and Andy Warhol. He had paintings by Banksy and Keith Haring. All that stuff was going up for sale. So not just Elton John fans might be coming to this auction, but collectors of art. He had different glasswares, you know, Jalouli, these wild glass sculptures. And as I said, this Bentley car. If you're a car collector, you might want this Bentley convertible. Yes, by the added attraction was it was owned by Elton John, but on its own, it was a beautiful Bentley convertible in prime condition. So not only was this auction about Elton John fans, but what he was a collector of other things that other collectors would want: jewelry, Chopard watches, Cartier watches, you know, different jewelry, you know, necklaces, and as I said before, watches, and you name it. Belt buckles. They had some pinball machines for sale. Neon signs from some of his concerts, from his Las Vegas show, the Red Piano. So the main thing certainly was the possessions in the house. As I said, there were Versace chairs and flatware and tables and artwork, you know, some three-dimensional artwork, as well as paintings and photographs that adorned the house. Then there were the personal possessions. There were different suits, there were stage costumes, but there was also regular clothes. And like I said, some of his well-known glasses and things like that. It was quite a collection of different things that at now 77 years old, you know, it's time to start thinking about downsizing and decluttering like anyone else. And so these things were valuable in their own right, and certainly they could bring in a lot of money at auction because they had the added prestige of being owned by Elton John. And so I went online and I went through all the different, there's about 8 different auctions. They were all separated into different things, jewelry, you know, I said artwork, you know, clothing, stage costumes, all their different names, you know, each auction. And 2 of them were going to be live auctions, and then the other 6 were going to be online. And it's almost like eBay, you know, the online ones. You go online and you register with Christie's, and then you bid. And they say, oh, sorry, and you want to bid more? And you basically do that. The online auctions, I think, were available for about 2 weeks. I think it was like February 8th or February 9th till about February 21st. And then that's when the live auction took place, the 2 live auctions took place. And then the online ones were basically toward the end of the month, about the 27th or so of February, where you could still bid on those. But some of the auctions were just live auction items where you had to get an invitation to go. So if you've never seen this before, you go online and all the items were up there, and they give like estimates of what they expect each item to go for. But when it comes to a famous person who owns something, the estimates are always low, and they always topple, and sometimes are triple and quadruple what they sell for, what the estimate was. Recently, I think David Gilmour of Pink Floyd auctioned off some of his famous guitars. Some of them got $3 million. I think Mark Knopfler might be doing the same thing. You know, some of the rock and roll memorabilia of some of the biggest stars and legends, they always go for outrageous prices. There are still people, especially baby boomers at this age, who, you know, decide, look, you know, they've got the means. Or maybe it's younger fans who, you know, there's a lot of tech billionaires out there, you know, celebrities, you name it, or anybody that, you know, that is got the good fortune to become a multi-millionaire, and they will spend money and good money on some of these well-known artifacts, especially from the rock and roll world. They still go well. There's Beatle auctions all the time. And as I said, many of the aging rockers now, the heritage acts, if you will, are doing the same thing. And they're realizing that, hey, you know, I'm not using these 900 guitars anymore. And I may have spent $75,000 or $100,000 on it, you know, 30 years ago, but I can make $3 or $4 million on it now. And some of these guitars or things like that are some of the most famous, well-known guitars, for instance, that some of these guitarists have played. They were the guitars that they used to compose and play some of the greatest albums of all time, or when they are on specific tours. Elton was even selling a piano that he had in his Atlanta residence that he composed the score to both Billy Elliot and Aida on. So they give you an estimate, and that's where the bidding starts. But like any auction, like you've seen on television, if you've never even been involved in an auction, they really are like that. The people that are there who are motivated to buy that, you do see the boom, oh, do we have 500, 600, 800? And this thing just starts to escalate. Sometimes, depending on the item, the estimate was high. But many times, especially in Elton's case here, the estimates were very low. In fact, there were 900 items, and they expected the auction to bring in $10 million. And it wound up bringing in $20 million. So it doubled the expectation. But those expectations, I think, and I spoke to one of the people who worked at Christie's when I went there, and I said, you know, for instance, the Bentley, a convertible Bentley. Right? I mean, a Bentley alone, you know, costs several hundred thousand. And this was a convertible in mint condition. They had the estimated price $25,000 to $35,000. So I saw this. I mentioned this to the woman. I said, so how do you come up with these estimates? I said, because that Bentley, I said, you can't get a Honda for $35,000. And she said, well, you know, some of those items that we expect to go, you know, we actually, we deliberately start the estimate low. Wow, what happened here? Just like you said, Reggie, I'm running out of pep. I only had X amount of pep. My voice only had X amount of pep, so I'm getting close. I gotta wrap this up. You put the whammy on me. I'm losing my pep. I'll be done soon. I'm gonna make sure every drop of pep gets out here. So she said that a lot of times we will set the estimate low just to get the bidding started, to get the momentum going. Because there might be some people who say, hey, you know what? For $25,000, what the heck? I'll bid on that. And it gets things rolling. At the end of the day, not surprisingly, that Bentley, that the estimates were from $25,000 to $35,000, that Bentley went for over $400,000. So, you know, you have to take these estimates with a grain of salt. Now, some of the items, they came in right at the estimate. Some of them were actually below the estimate. But many of them were, if not at the estimate, they were 2, 3, and even sometimes 4 times the estimate based on the uniqueness of the item, the historic value of the item, you name it, or the intrinsic value of it, which then was also multiplied because it was owned by Elton John. So I'm going through all the online items, and I go to the area that said this is where the one auction, online auction, where the costumes would be listed. Well, don't you know it? Guess what was up for auction. Now, on that tour, as I said, about 10 years ago, I saw three different versions of the Captain Fantastic outfit jacket. I saw a blue version, a red version, and a green, dark greenish version, almost grayish greenish. Two of them were up for auction. I couldn't believe this. I had always said, wouldn't that be the coolest thing to own? That even before I thought they'd ever be up for auction and ever be available to the public, I sort of said, oh, that would be the centerpiece of my collection. I would love to own that. I love that album. That jacket looks so cool. I love that logo. Hey, when you look at the logo for my podcast, right, what do you think Captain Podtastic is a playoff of? Captain Fantastic. If you look at the logo for this podcast, that's the logo from Captain Fantastic. I just did a little altering of it to put Captain Podtastic, but the lettering, the font, the way the captain is in one and the font, that's where I got it. That's where the name came from. That's how much I love this album. I named this podcast after it. So now suddenly that idea of owning that jacket was not some far-flung dream. It was real. It was attainable. It was there. Except the estimates had it having, it was the suit, it was the jacket and the pants. The estimate had it going between $5,000 and $10,000. Now look, folks, there is no doubt that over the last 50 years, well, my first concert was in 1976 when I was a little kid. So almost 50 years that I've been going to concerts, and I've been a fan of Elton since 1973. There is no question. In the last 50-some years, I have spent a lot of money on concerts and memorabilia and albums and you name it, pinball machines and glasses and you name it. And the travel involved, I understand that. As I said before, don't have any kids, so had disposable income, just my wife and me. So I know that I've spent, I have no idea what the amount is over that period of time. I wouldn't even want to guess at what it was. But at this point in my life, while I would love to have owned this, I was also a part of me, you know, the rabid Elton John fan said, oh my God, I have to have that. But suddenly this decluttered part of Jim Toronto, this older part of Jim Toronto, this more maybe mature and sensible side began to creep in and actually influence the rabid Elton John fan who for at least 10 years had been lusting after that jacket. So I had this internal conflict going on. I know how much I wanted it. I know how much it would have been so cool to have that displayed and even put it on and make it a centerpiece of my collection. I would love to just walk by it every day and say, oh my God, this is the coolest thing on earth. But the sensible side to me, which many times was overcome by the rabid fan, suddenly the sensible side was winning or was right there butting heads with the rabid fan who would do anything to see Elton or whatever it was. If it was Elton, you know, it was about Elton, there was no question. So at this point in my life, the $5,000 and $10,000 estimate was pretty steep. And I knew damn well that Elton John fans around the world, and this was open to online, it was open to around the world, I knew that that jacket, that suit, but it was mainly the jacket. The pants weren't that big of a deal. They just had some, you know, striping on the side, some glittery striping. It was the jacket. It was designed. It was the Captain Fantastic logo design with all these, you know, white rhinestones that went around it and down the back of the jacket. It was gorgeous. I knew that Elton John fans, that jacket wasn't just appealing to me. I knew that that was going to be one of the hottest items up for sale. There was a lot of cool things. But in terms of number of bids, I knew that that thing was going to go for at least $30,000, at least three times the highest on the high end of that estimate. And, you know, that's hard for me to justify. Now, I don't know. 20 years ago, maybe it wouldn't have been that hard to justify. 20 years ago, it probably wouldn't have been that expensive either with inflation. So I was very torn. I've got pictures of that jacket, you know, of Elton wearing that jacket from the concerts where I just zoomed in right on the logo across the back, you know, the shoulders of where it was. And I just love that picture and I love that jacket. So that's why, at the very least, I had to go to New York and see it in person. And there were two versions. There was the light blue one and the dark green one. The light blue one, because I knew it was going to be a centerpiece, that one was on a mannequin in a display that was kind of behind some ropes. But then the other one was just on in another room on a hanger, the green one. And it was turned around so you could see the back. And I did get a chance to look at it and touch it. And I didn't put it on. I probably could have. But it looked so cool. I mean, I saw it. I mean, I used to always sit very close. I'd be right up in front of the stage. So I saw that jacket when he was wearing it up close. But now I actually got to touch it and feel it and really, you know, get a bird's eye view of that. And it was very cool. And I was just shaking because there it was. As I said before, it was this idea, this dream, this possible thing that seemed kind of far-fetched. And now it was real. It was for the taking. And so now the question became, did I want to do this? Should I do it? Could I do it? It's a lot of money. And do I really need it? And that was a new aspect being a collector, you don't even think about, do I need it? Of course you need it. If you're a collector of anything, whether it's Elton John stuff or whatever it is, of course you need it. There's something inherent in you that if you're a collector, I can't explain it. I don't know how I got it. I don't know where I got it. I don't know if I was born with it, but in any collector out there of anything, whether it's statues and you know, Hummels, whatever you might, you know, hockey pucks, whatever you might, right, Craig? Whatever you collect, you know that you don't know why, you don't know how, you don't know what, but you know, oh, it's burning in you and you have to have it. And you struggle with yourself, especially when it's an item that you know is in great demand and it comes with a high price tag and you go, yes, or no. And when you say yes, you feel guilty because you know you spent too much money. When you say no, you feel guilty because you know you should have bought it. There's no winning on this. And this may have been the last cool Elton John item that I really wanted. The temptation was great. Now, don't forget, I also had to sell this idea to my wife. You know, I mean, you know, we've been married for more than 30 years, and this is a partnership, and I can't just go off. And as I said, when I saw the price, even to me, I was like, you know, this would be an extravagance. This would be a crazy extravagance. Even at that price, it would be a silly extravagance. I knew it would be. It would be something that, could I afford it? Yeah, but really, we're at the edge here. This is really frivolous. You know what I mean? Especially at my age now. You know, it's not like I'm going to have this for 50 years, right? But this is the thing. All of a sudden, this logic was entering my thought process. That never happened before when it came to Elton collecting. The logic of it never came in. It was like, oh my God, it's available? It's real? Yeah, okay. More times than not, I said, okay. And here was something that I really wanted, always wanted, and here it was, and I touched it, and I saw it, and it was real, and I had the opportunity to get it. What would I do? So, the online auction is about, as I said, maybe 3 weeks long. So, I just said to myself, who knows? Now, maybe I'm overestimating the demand for this, right? I know it's a tough time for people, inflation-wise. Maybe, who knows? So the first step I had to do was register. And I didn't even register when I went there in person, which I could have done. Because I said, I'm here to see this. The logical side of me, when I went to New York just to look at the whole collection, was I'm here as a fan just to look. I'm not going to buy anything. I've got everything I need. You know, I've done it all. I've been to the 215 concerts. I'm fine. But of course, there was that little voice behind me says, yeah, but it's the Captain Fantastic jacket. What are you doing? You crazy guy. It's there. But I resisted. I was proud of myself to some extent. I did not register for the auction when I was there in person. I told myself as I was going there, no, this is ridiculous. I'm not going to, it's $5,000. At the bottom of the estimate was $5,000. The high end of the estimate was 20, it was 10, and I figured that was going to go for 30. So I'm like, no, this is crazy. This is just crazy. This is not going to happen. It's sad. I wish I had that much disposable income. I wish I would have invested in Apple 30 years ago, but I didn't, right? So... So that's the way it is. And I certainly have to be happy with what I've been able to do. I've been able to travel and see Elton John all around the world, you know, 215 times. And I do have one of the jackets that I always wanted and a pair of his glasses. So I've got all that I'm allowed. I'm content at this point in my life. My collection is fine. I'm going to have my own problems. You know, what am I going to do with it? Ultimately, right? do I really need to add something like this? Logically, of course not. But fan-wise, oh, it's right there. What do I do? So I go online several times. It's up, you know, now it'll be online. It's like eBay. You know, the auction ends on February 27th or 28th, whatever it was. So it's up there. You can go up there and look at it and bid on it at 3 in the morning or 2 in the afternoon. It doesn't matter. So I'd go online and see where it was, and I'd always check on it. And for the first couple of weeks, of course, like any auction, even online auctions as well as in-person auctions, it starts slow, and then as it's getting down to the wire, and either the auctioneer in person says final bid, or online it says this thing closes at 2 o'clock on this date, that's when the bids, if it's really an in-demand item, right toward the end is when the bidding really starts, and it starts to go crazy, and then you get into that competition. So I didn't expect the first couple of weeks for the price to really start escalating, because it would probably escalate more as time ran out on the auction. And I think it was 2 o'clock p.m. Eastern time. I believe it was the 27th of February. Or 28th, something like that. I think it was the 27th. So I was, throughout those weeks, I was watching them. I was watching it. And it really was stuck at like the lowest end. So I was like, wow, maybe I underestimated this. It's now been 2 weeks. Now, in the meantime, this adds a little intrigue to the story. When the final day of the auction is happening, I will not be home. I will be on our trip I just told you about in the last couple of episodes in the Arctic Circle on a cruise. Now, I brought my computer with me, so I could continue to monitor this, and I could make a bid if I wanted to. But I was going to, if I did that, I would have been on the cruise with the time difference. I mean, it was crazy. But yet here I was watching this thing. So before I left, I knew the processes of this. And I said, well, you know, okay, this $5,000 is a crazy price. I shouldn't do this. And I know that it's not going to go for $5,000. I know it's going to go for at least $10,000. And really, I know it's going to go for $30,000 at least. So, and I know that when you bid online, because I've bid on things even on eBay, they send you an email that says, thank you for your bid. You're the high bidder, right? So you go, oh, that's cool. And then if you get outbid, you get another email whenever that happens, when your bid is topped, that says, sorry, you've been outbid. Do you want to bid again? Because they want to get the bids going, right? They want to make you aware you're interested in this. You've been outbid if you haven't been on the website for a while. They do that on eBay too. And that's what Christie does. It's the same concept. So in my mind, I said, well, you know, I'm going to put a bid in because I know it's going to get toppled. So I'll go in at the early point. So I'll get the cool little email that says I bid on it. And then I'll get the cool email that says I've been outbid. And there's my, that's that out, that email, that's my possession. That's my collection. My bid and my unsuccessful bid email back from Christie's. That's what I will add to my collection. I'll print it out and that will be, I bid on it. I didn't win it. But I've been on it. So those are the internal games I was playing with myself, because I so wanted this. One side of me so wanted this. And the other side of me said, this is ridiculous. You should not be spending this kind of money on this at this time of your life. And that was the internal struggle. But even though I knew and expected and did not want to pay the $5,000 for that coat, I had no intentions of paying that. I did not want to pay it, but I did place the bid. So that I could at least have bid on it and get that email back, right? So I took a deep breath because I'm, and like I said, in my mind, I know I'm not going to have to pay this money. This is nothing, really. What I'm doing here doesn't really amount to anything because this bid is going to get outbid. So who cares? This is more just for the effort. This is more just for the show of it and for some weird little, you know, to ease some of the angst I was going through. Like, hey, at least you bid on it, right? Once again, I'm playing all these internal games with myself. But even when I went down and then hit that button to hit bid, I watched so many TV shows like the Dick Van Dyke Show and all these other shows from the past where they have these crazy, you know, even on Seinfeld. You remember the great Seinfeld episode where Elaine goes to bid for the bag of JFK golf clubs against Sue Ellen Mischke, her arch rival, and they start bidding, and Peterman said you should can only bid 10,000. She wound up bidding like 20,000 because she got into this competition with her arch rival from grammar school. And so she kept pulling up putting up the paddle. So I've seen what happens. And sometimes you get burned, right? And what if in my mind I'm saying, look, this is a cool jacket. It's way too cool. There's no way it's going to go for this low price. So I'll make the bid at the lowest price because it's going to get toppled and I'll get the unsuccessful bid email. I'll be fine. But what if it didn't? I would be on the line. And don't forget that at whatever price you bid and win at, then there's added prices. There's tax. There's another fee that Christie adds on. A lot of times there's another $2,000 or $3,000, depending on the price. It's a percentage of what you did. So even at the lowest price, there still could have been like $7,000. I'm like, this is crazy. But I was very confident that jacket was going to be a prized possession, or at least be very popular with fans, and that low bid was going to be toppled in no time at all. So I registered online and I bid. And when I pressed that button, bid, believe me, it was not easy because the rabid fan in me said, go do it. But that other, you know, I had an angel and a devil on my shoulders. I really did. And the angel said, go do it. Go, you know, don't do it. Don't do it. It's, you don't need that email. This is silly. It's a stupid. Be mature. And that little devil on the other side said, it's the Captain Fantastic jacket. You've always wanted it. Just hit the button. Hit the button. Hit the button. Well, that little damn devil won. And I hit the button. And much to my surprise, my bid stayed up there for about 2 or 3 days as the high bid. Now, this was early on in the auction. And I'm like, oh, my God. Wait a minute. Part of me was excited, but a part of me was then scared again, too. Oh, my God, I'm going to have to pay this. That wasn't my plan. I really wasn't expecting to pay this. And I don't really should. And I don't even, this is not right. Oh, my God, am I going to get burned on this? I really shouldn't be spending this much money on this. I know I've spent a lot of money over the past, but now that's not the smartest thing to do. And I kept checking it, and I was still the high bid. Finally, thankfully, while I was on the trip, when I was on the cruise checking it, I still had the high bid. And now it was getting close, and I was like, oh, my God, what have I done? This is like a bad sitcom. This is like Seinfeld. This is like Dick Van Dyke Show. But then, oh, what a sigh of relief. I woke up one morning, and I had an email from Christie's that said, you have been outbid. Oh, my God. I mean, I was not even sleeping a couple of nights as this thing was getting closer. But as I said before, as the end of the auction starts to come, that's when the real bidders start to come in and the price starts to go up. My bid was outbid. And as I predicted, that jacket that I bid on went for $25,000. The blue one went for $30,000, but the one that I bid on went for $25,000. I didn't buy it. I didn't get it. I do have my emails, which I have printed, and I have put them somewhere, that I did bid on it. There is a part of me that misses the fact that I could have had that jacket. I've always wanted it. And that rabid Elton fan in me always will hit myself. But the other side, the little angel, actually did beat the devil and said, you know what? And I was not prepared at all to spend $25,000. So no, it really wasn't a real thing. It wasn't a real possibility. I knew. Now, I don't know who got it. I don't know if the Hard Rock bought it. I don't know if a private collector bought it. I'm not sure. They don't tell you that. But the realized price was $25,000. And that was way, way out of my price range. There is no way that I could have justified ever paying for that. So when I saw the price that I expected it to go at in that kind of range, the more sensible side of me, the mature side of me, the real side of me that was even when I was at the auction place where I didn't even register, that side thankfully prevailed. I did get my unsuccessful email bid. I've printed it up. I have that. I still have pictures of it. I have a picture. I did get a chance to hold the jacket, touch it, see it, feel it. Maybe that's enough. Of course, there's a little part of me in the back of my mind that says, oh, God, you had it right in your hands and you maybe could have done it. And maybe it would have been a crazy, horrible financial decision. But, oh, it would have been so cool to have it. But thankfully, and maybe this comes with age, maybe it comes with wisdom, I don't know. But there's more a part of me that's glad I didn't do it. And that's an interesting thing as you get older. I'm happy I still had that youthful passion and excitement to consider it. So that fire hasn't died in me. But I was a little sad, and that's exciting, right? But I was a little sad that the other side did win. And I was a little sad that I didn't have that jacket. And whatever that inherent collector in me, it's still there. And it is a lesson about getting older and being more sensible. As I said, 20 years ago, I probably would have not even thought twice. So somewhere in the world, two people or two corporations or somebody have those Elton John Captain Fantastic jackets. Congratulations to whoever were the winners. And I'd love to have an invite to see it one more time. And so ends another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNRadio.com or wherever you go to find your favorite podcast. We are there. And don't forget to tell your friends, tell your family, tell anyone who listens to a podcast that your favorite podcast is Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, and it should be theirs too. Your loyalty and devotion are much appreciated. Hope you enjoyed episode number 410. I'm Jim Toronto. I ain't here on business. I'm only here for fun. You've been listening to Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. From the end of my mind to your ears. Oh, I wanted that jacket so bad.